The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Madeline Frank Reeves is titled, Here's How to Be More Confident Starting Today. We all recognize confident people when we see them, the ones who seem to truly love themselves and exude that little extra something that makes them appear invincible. But confidence is much more than a personality trait. It's a skill that can be learned and an important one at that. Researchers find that we're more apt to follow a confident person than a competent person, says Dr. Valerie Young, author of The Secret Thoughts of Successful Women. If you're willing to push yourself outside your comfort zone, it is absolutely achievable to be more confident, and in turn, project that self-esteem. Let these tips on how to increase your confidence in any situation be your starting point. To be more confident in yourself, find supportive friends. It's crucial to spend time with friends and family who have your best interests at heart and are there to build you up every step of the way. When we are embarking on something new and our confidence is fragile, we need family or friends to help encourage us to go after those things we fear, explains Louisa Jewell, author of Wire Your Brain for Confidence, The Science of Conquering Self-Doubt. Self-doubt is socially constructed, she says. So if you tell your bestie about a goal of yours, whether it's going after a new job or starting a diet challenge, and they scoff at it, your confidence will likely be knocked right down. Jules suggests sharing any goals or ideas with your most supportive friends first, not because you need them to agree with you on everything, but because you know they will at least be positive and constructive in their feedback. And then, believe you'll be successful. If your inner circle can help you believe in your ability to succeed, it goes a long way toward helping you take concrete steps toward your goals. There's a more action-oriented kind of confidence called self-efficacy, or the knowledge that you'll reach your goal no matter the endeavor, Jules says. If you trust that you'll be successful, you generally move toward the behaviors necessary to make it happen. Want to be more confident at work? Imagine you already are. Use a little mental trickery to boost your confidence and performance in the office. How? Dedicate a few minutes each day to imagining being great at a task. By fantasizing about doing something well, your brain acts as though you actually have. Jewell explains that the same neurons that process imagination overlap with neurons that process recalling things. So by visualizing that we've done something successfully, it becomes easier and we feel more confident when we actually do it. Or in other words, our brains say, I've done this before, I can do it again, explains Jewell, and we feel more relaxed in the moment. Then, fake it till you make it. Pretending to act differently than you feel can actually change your emotions, says Dr. Young, citing a Wake Forest University study that asked people to act like extroverts, finding that the more assertive and energetic the students feigned to be, the happier they felt. So, for example, if you dread brainstorming sessions at work, acting energetic in that setting can actually help you to enjoy it more and ultimately thrive. Or, if you're just hoping to be a more confident speaker, focus on your audience. The best thing you can do when getting up to speak in front of a group is to think about the positive benefits you'll bring to the audience with the information you're sharing. Claire Shipman, co-author of The Confidence Code for Girls, suggests thinking about the speech through the lens of how it's benefiting the cause versus how it gets a point about yourself across. But what if you make a mistake? That's a good thing, Shipman reminds us. People really like authenticity. So if, for example, you misspeak in a presentation or interview, it's okay to say, I'm a little nervous today, and then go on to correct yourself. In fact, Shipman adds, it establishes that you are confident enough to expose the fact that you're feeling nervous or vulnerable, which in a way makes you seem uber confident. She also has a trick in case you lose your train of thought mid-presentation. Take a moment to look down, pause, and take a breath. It's a moment for you to collect yourself if you're nervous, and it signals that you're in control of the time and that you're about to reveal something really important, she advises. Compared to filling the space with or you know, this tactic has a much more powerful impact. And finally, allow yourself to, well, not feel confident. Give yourself permission to ask questions and make mistakes free of judgment. What if you knew you had the right to have an off day, to be in the midst of a learning curve, to say, "I don't understand," muses Dr. Jung. If you did, I guarantee you'd feel a lot more confident. Essentially, to be more confident, start by cutting yourself some slack. Our next article by Naomi Barr and Samantha Vincenti is titled, "The Power of the Thank You Note." Yes, in the age of social media, when you can announce to the world, or at least your 542 followers, how great someone is, we're here to tell you that the humble personal thank you note may be more consequential than ever. At its heart, gratitude is about recognizing what's most important. Grateful people actively look for and value the good things in their life, says Philip Watkins, PhD, a professor of psychology at Eastern Washington University. A letter of appreciation isn't just an easy and increasingly rare way to make somebody feel pretty darn valued. Research says sending one sets you up for a happiness boost too. For sure, any type of gratitude practice can improve your well-being, but it appears that acts such as writing thank you notes or gratitude letters may have even deeper resonance than others. My team and I were interested in whether it's more happiness-inducing to express gratitude internally to the intended person or publicly. For example, writing in my diary about how grateful I am for my mom versus writing her directly to tell her so versus stating how grateful I am for her on social media, says Sonia Labermersky, PhD, a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. Not surprisingly, we found that people feel the most happiness or joy when they express gratitude directly to someone. So what makes a gratitude letter or thank you note so powerful? I think it comes down to three things, says Lumbermersky. Connection to the people you're thankful to, because that's what makes life worth living. Humility, because when you express gratitude, you realize it's not just about you. And inspiration, because when you express gratitude to another person, your parents, friends, mentors, you want to prove yourself worthy of their efforts. You want to be a better person. If the feel-good payoff is so good, why do we sometimes think, "I so appreciate that person," and then never actually tell them? It could be for a number of guilt-inducing reasons. You're busy, then so much time passes it feels too late. You don't know what to say. The depth of emotion you're feeling makes you squirm. This guide is full of advice and inspiration that will help make the process easier, so whenever you feel the urge to share your appreciation, there will be nothing to hold you back. A note from Oprah. The best gift, whose value to both giver and receiver will be priceless, is the gift of words straight from the heart. And when they're written and not just spoken, they last forever. It's an irresistible way to immediately connect. I love you and appreciate you, and here's why. A few other things I've noticed. Thank you letters remind us of the power of kindness. Every action you take has consequences you can't foresee. It's the ripple effect. And when your actions are done with the intention of helping others, the ripples are wonderful to behold. I experience it every time I get a letter from a girl who has attended the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls, or OLAG, whose life has been forever changed by education. I've been privileged to help many people over the years, and it's always a gift to be reminded of the long-term influence of intentional goodness shared. Their value grows. Over the years, I've received some amazing notes, and I found that they get even better with time. Notes from Mike Nichols and Sidney Poitier and Barbara Walters, Nelson Mandela and Coretta Scott King, from the people closest to me, Stedman, Gail, Bob Green. A niece and some cousins have shared words from their heart about me, to me, that mattered. All these words live in a treasure box of letters that I cherish. No sentiment is too small. I once sprained my knee while hiking. Every night, without being asked, Stedman prepared an ice pack to help ease the swelling. It was such a sweet gesture. So I didn't just thank him, I wrote him a note. It's the thought that counts, carries such meaning and value when you actually take the time to share the thought. Your etiquette questions answered. Times have gotten more relaxed, and so have some of the rules for thank you notes. Is a thank you email or text okay? Given the overscheduled, extremely online world that most of us live in, a thank you email in many cases is fabulous, says etiquette expert Diane Gottsman. I think we need to take the judgment out of the effort. Electronic thank yous, yes, even texts, are particularly appropriate for intangible gifts such as a childcare favor or even a professional introduction. But for holiday presents and weddings, baby showers, or similar major life events for which you've received gifts, sending a paper note remains the gold standard. Can I send a printout of a letter I've typed up? Sure, but if a lack of confidence in your handwriting is the reason, I'd rather see the chicken scratch because it's from the heart, Gottsman says. Etiquette expert Jacqueline Whitmore recalls finding a scribbled thank you note from her late mother, which she now considers invaluable. There's nothing more sentimental than seeing a loved one's handwriting, she says. Do I still need to send a note for a job interview? Yes. Whether it's your first or your third round, always send a post-interview note. An immediate email works, but you'll stand out more with a card a few days later. A thank you gift someone gave me? Nope, that's overkill, says etiquette expert Elaine Swan. A bereavement card or gift? Technically, yes. It's proper to send a card for money, flowers, or help you receive after a loss, according to Whitmore. But really, no one should expect a response from a grieving person, and certainly not a timely one, she says. Is it ever too late to send a thank you? Short answer, no, says Swan. Though thank you notes for wedding and baby presents should ideally be mailed between 3 days to 6 months after receipt of the gift, it's always better to send it late than never send one at all, she says. Double the positive vibes. We rarely see the joy on someone's face when they read a note we've sent. Writer Molly Sims got to experience just that when, for a class she was taking on happiness, she was tasked with writing a letter to someone she had never thanked, then reading it to them, preferably in person. I debated for days before nervously selecting a teacher I'd been close with. Nancy, the exacting, sardonic leader of our high school drama club, where I'd once spent countless extracurricular hours. Go ahead, ask me to sing anything from West Side Story. We arranged a FaceTime on a Sunday morning. We hadn't spoken in almost 20 years, and I was preparing myself for an award-winning weird conversation. After we caught up, I explained my mission. Oh boy, should I grab tissues, Nancy said, chuckling. I launched into the letter talking about when we met freshman year. You were, and probably still are, a demanding figure, but your insistence on getting the best out of us felt like a form of true respect, and it made me step up in ways I hadn't thought I was capable of. I started verbally stumbling, too teary to read my screen properly. I looked up to see her eyes flooded too. When I finished, Nancy buried her face in her hands, her shoulders shaking. I thought about the nearly 40 years she spent teaching, the infinite nights I painted scenery alongside her as we listened to Bonnie Raitt on a boombox, the thousands of kids she's pushed and bolstered the way she did me, the insufficient thanks she's received. At that moment, we were tied together by a cord of memory, reaching each other through lost time, sending and retrieving a torrent of positive energy. I don't know what the meaning of life is, I thought, but maybe it's something like this. My God, what a beautiful letter, Nancy said, wiping her eyes. I can't tell you how good that makes me feel to hear. But did reading that make you feel happy? It did. It really, really did. So make it a ritual. It's more fun to write when you have pretty tools to do it with, says Whitmore. It also gives you serious incentive to make letter writing a regular practice. After writing 3 letters of gratitude over 3 weeks, participants in one study reported higher life satisfaction and fewer depressive symptoms. If you've got a desk at home, have a section where you keep a beautiful dish of pens and different stationery, suggests Whitmore. What's stopping you? One likely reason gratitude evolved was to inspire the urge to bond with people willing to help you. That made us curious to explore why people don't express appreciation when they feel it, says Amit Kumar, PhD, assistant professor of psychology and marketing at the University of Texas at Austin. In each of three experiments, volunteers wrote thank you letters, then predicted the recipients' reactions. Later, the recipients were asked how the notes actually made them feel. I thought it wasn't a big deal. Senders of the first batch of missives overestimated how awkward receivers would feel and significantly underestimated how surprised and happy they would be. Someone said they were bubbling over with joy, says Kumar. It seems we don't always recognize the value of expressing gratitude. I'm not great at expressing myself. Another group of participants rated their competence at writing thank yous. While they fretted about not being as eloquent as they would have liked, the beneficiaries of their words tended to focus on the warmth of the intent. I didn't want to seem fake. The third cohort was asked to think of a few people to whom they were grateful and choose whom to thank. Most wrote to those they thought would respond favorably and not to those they assumed would react negatively. For example, thinking the sentiment wasn't sincere. Imagining the worst-kept participants from possibly making a meaningful connection. Bottom line, no matter what your hesitation, assume the best and just do it, says Kumar. Something so small can make a big difference. Our next article by Hamilton Kane is titled, From Takes on the Sex Pistols to Madonna vs. Beyoncé, Khalifa Sana's Ode to Pop Music Thrills. The secret to being a great chef, Jacques Pepin observed in his 2003 memoir, The Apprentice, is the willingness to eat anything. A similar omnivorous drive fuels Khalifa Sana's magisterial engrossing debut, Major Labels, A History of Popular Music in Seven Genres, which serves up a la carte his takes on rock, R&B, country, punk, hip-hop, dance, and pop. A New Yorker staff writer and former New York Times music critic, a veteran of countless concerts and interviews, Sana is his own Spotify channel. It is easy enough to acknowledge the evident diversity of popular music, he opines in the introduction. But diversity is a rather uninspiring term, conjuring up a polite and static world where people have the serenity to accept one another's differences. More often, popular music has been not merely diverse, but divisive, riven by crossover successes and cruel excommunications, rival fan bases, and sneering feuds. The biracial son of a Gambian academic and a white South African linguist, Sana came to the United States as a child when his parents were offered jobs first at Harvard, then at Yale. As a 14-year-old in New Haven, Connecticut, he discovered punk and persuaded his mother to take him to a Ramones concert. She sat at the club's bar while he thrashed and shoved in the mosh pit. As an undergraduate at Harvard, he immersed himself in the culture of the college station, WHRB, where he expanded his taste and honed the curatorial tools he's used throughout his career. These years of listening to a vast range of genres and subgenres and thinking relentlessly about them all imbue Major Labels. The persistence of genres, the persistence of labels, has shaped the way music is made and also the way we hear it. And so this book aims to acknowledge that. This book is literally generic. Sana faced the same narrative challenges that confronted Ann Powers in Good Booty 2017. How can he wrangle so many artists into a cohesive arc, chart their rises and falls, their dizzying accomplishments, and sudden flameouts? He breaks up each chapter with subheads, allowing colorful detours away from his larger axis. Thus, we learn that in the 1990s, Casey Kasem, the beloved host of American Top 40, had to censor his countdowns as hip-hop artists began to chart. These hits disturbed the show's mellow mood and annoyed some of its baby boomer listeners. Sana's analysis of country music allows him access to how and why this genre often feels insular and southern, rife with twangy ballads and Confederate flags. For Sana, country is a country within a county, self-reliant if suspicious, with its own discrete forms and innovations. He's never outgrown his zeal for punk. In addition to the Ramones, he highlights the raucous brilliance of the Sex Pistols, Green Day, and Black Flag. The promise of punk is that it offered room for practically everything. In its broadest sense, loving punk meant being non-mainstream, a slippery and seductive identity that was often more appealing than the music itself. And Santa's chapter on hip-hop is worth the price of the hardcover alone. He evokes such iconic groups as Public Enemy and Run-DMC, as well as the pivotal magazine, The Source. Santa lauds Kanye West's iconoclasm as a pushback against received wisdom about the genre. Part of what's dispiriting about the idea of conscious hip-hop is that so often conscious refers to a rather cramped range of cultural and ideological influences. Great 70s soul records, unimpeachable observations about black pain and black power, Santa writes. But if it makes sense to talk about conscious hip-hop, then surely West's restless and unpredictable and hypersensitive body of work fits the description. He sometimes seems intent on reconciling with himself all of hip-hop's incompatible tendencies, shadowboxing with as many critics as he cycles through roles, from party host to rabble-rouser to anti-hero. Perhaps the most striking feature of major labels is Santa's ecumenical approach. He's drawn to outlaws and normies alike. There are surprises here. He devotes more sentences to the Carpenters than to the Clash. Culture Club's Boy George comes across as a bold, uncompromising change agent, far more than just a frivolous gender-bending pop act. The book not only celebrates genres, it also beautifully illuminates cross-pollination. Both The Clash and Culture Club incorporate reggae sounds into their albums. And yet, for all its disavowal of hierarchies, major labels embraces our need to categorize, to exalt some kinds of music over others. For Santa, this is the critic's conundrum in a nutshell. Why do we feel the urge to persuade others of our own taste, whether in music or fashion or books? There's a dash of philosophy in his conclusion. Human beings tend to disagree about music because human beings are disagreeable. When we complain about music, what we are really complaining about is other people, he writes. As long as people obsess about popular music, they will doubtless find themselves seized by the conviction that they are right, and their neighbors, no matter how nice or smart they may seem, are profoundly and puzzlingly wrong. In a recent interview, Santa fielded a few candid questions and a Madonna versus Beyonce curveball from Oprah Daily. In an age of over-specialization, you go for a more generalist approach in major labels. Why? It follows the arc of my life, which began with an extremely particular interest. When I was 14, I was converted to the gospel of punk rock. For a few years, that was all I cared about. I wanted to listen to everything that was punk and weird and underground and noisy and difficult and nothing else. Over the years, I found my way through punk to all these other genres and became a bit of a generalist and someone who likes all kinds of stuff. Because of all those decades of listening and writing about music, I realized I had a story to tell, a theory of the case about why music was the way it was. So I liked the challenge, the absurd task I had set myself about writing a history of popular music, the idea of explaining to people what had happened since the Beatles. How would you describe your process? It was really important to me that this book feel like a story or a series of stories and not read like an encyclopedia. Within each of these seven major stories, I had to figure out what the plot was, and I did that by going back and listening to a lot of music and reading. Some ideas I already had about what happened. All these genres have something in common. They're all making it onto the Billboard charts or onto MTV. They're all swimming in the same commercial soup. From country to R&B, you were confronting a broad spectrum of politics. How did politics play a role in the background of major labels? One of the most important things for me when I write is to not be led astray by my own assumptions. Often when people are thinking and writing about music, there are political assumptions about what music should endorse, what it should stand for, how it should function. I think that politics plays different roles in different genres, something I like. It makes sense that music is a popular, and in that sense, populist form. It makes sense that it would be driven by the various and conflicting political priorities of the people who listen, that it would reflect what people worry about in America. Sometimes our view of music can be shaped from the outside. With a genre like hip-hop, a lot of the people who loved it and took time to study it and to promote it did so partly because of their own political commitment. There was an idea from early on in hip-hop that this should be a music that speaks to issues of poverty and race and is in some sense a continuation of the civil rights struggle. The only problem with that idea is that throughout the history of the music, activism wasn't necessarily what the hip-hop musicians themselves were most interested in. It wasn't necessarily what hip-hop audiences were most eager to hear. What you see in hip-hop, if you look closely at it, are moments when a rapper makes a commentary on a track or in an interview. You often see joking, you see irony, you see ambivalence, you see contradiction. I wanted to be careful to write about hip-hop as it has actually existed, not hip-hop as some of its champions might have wanted. Even in country music, you have these very political moments, but you also have a small C conservatism within the industry, within the genre, that pushes back at the idea of any politics. You get the sense that the executives who run country music would like to stay out of trouble. Here's my underrated, overrated question. Is dance music overrated or underrated? At a certain point, I would have said that dance music was underrated. That might still be the case. For many readers, the dance chapter will be the most obscure. Most people probably don't know that house and techno were created by black producers in the American Midwest in the 1980s. But even if they do, because dance music works so differently from these other genres, because it doesn't tend to produce huge classic blockbuster albums, although it does produce some great albums, a lot of people don't necessarily know these names. For fans of music in general, many of them will hopefully be interested to learn more about dance. Which chapter was the most fun to write? The punk chapter was fun and scary at the same time. I was writing about myself. The rock chapter was fun to write because it was such a big gulp, such a big challenge. The idea that I would try to swallow and digest this sprawling history and make it legible and make it fun, the fact that I would get to write about death metal and Paul Simon in the same chapter, that's definitely the kind of thing I enjoy. What was your favorite anecdote or detail you unearthed while writing Major Labels? One thing that was really fun was revisiting the Pamela DeBar's book. It came out in 1987 at the height of hair metal. Pamela was someone who was hanging out in the scene in the 1960s and 70s with the bands. Her book is called I'm With the Band, Confessions of a Groupie. The G word is this term that's often a pejorative, and she reclaims it. She was like, yeah, I'm a groupie, someone who's a fan of the music. Part of the fun was having sexual encounters with the people who had made it, and part of the fun was just hanging out. That book, if people go back and revisit it now, it's really perceptive. It's just delightful to read because she has all these crazy stories about things that happened, but it's also really perceptive about the power dynamics that shape that world and about the emergence of rock stardom. It's really fun to read her take on how rock stardom was invented and how she thinks about it, how it works, and how these dudes are slowly starting to figure out, oh, we're rock stars. That means we can or maybe have to act in a certain way. Rock music is in its imperial phase. They perceive themselves and are perceived by fans as giants bestriding the earth. We take that for granted now. Who has recently popped out, jiggling your sixth sense about who this artist is and will become? Like some large portion of humanity, I had that experience this year with Olivia Rodrigo, who was best known until recently as a Disney actress, star of High School Musical, The Musical. And then she released this song, Driver's License, this beautiful, impassioned, fun breakup song, and then puts out this album, Sour, which is remarkably single-minded at a time when a lot of albums feel like grab bags or playlists. Sour is a breakup album. And almost all the songs are about feelings of ache and resentment and confusion and anger and sadness that characterize a breakup. It draws a bit from pop punk. She swipes a riff from Elvis Costello. It's really a cannily put together album, the kind that makes me wonder what else she's going to do. Sometimes that's the kind of music that lasts the longest. Think of Hit Me Baby One More Time by Britney Spears. That song has never left the airwaves. When it came out, there might have been a perception that it was radio disposable. Now it's clearly a modern classic. That's one of the things I like about popular music. It pushes back against pretension. 50 years from now, which artist will be considered more influential, Madonna or Beyoncé? Huh, that's a really good question. The argument for Madonna, she might be a little easier to imitate than Beyoncé. You've seen that, whether it's Katy Perry, Britney Spears, or Lady Gaga. You've seen a lot of people who follow her template. She's not an operatic singer. She's very canny in that she assembled this wide-ranging, inclusive, futuristic idea of what mainstream pop music could be, and that's just so galvanizing to generations of people. An argument you can make for Beyoncé is that Madonna had a head start, right? Maybe we're just beginning to see the emergence now of generations who are inspired by Beyoncé. She might be a little harder to imitate. For that reason, she might be more inspirational as a figure. One of the things about Madonna that people might not realize now was how controversial she was. Yeah, sex, the book. How much people hated her. From the right and left, at times she was loathed in a way that's not true of Beyoncé. You don't really have the equivalent. When you have the First Lady, Michelle Obama, revering Beyoncé, suffice it to say, you don't really have a situation where Nancy Reagan or Barbara Bush were saying that about Madonna. In that sense, the reverence that people have for Beyoncé, it's possible that she might have a halo. It's possible that Beyoncé's life, her example, her music, are inspiring to people in the way saints are, in a different way from Madonna's thing, which is more playful, more controversy-seeking. As she's pushed on in her career, Beyoncé did a lot of rhythmic experimentation. She has an incredible sense of rhythm as a singer. The way she approaches the beat, I can imagine how that would be very musically inspirational to future generations in ways that we can't necessarily wrap our minds around now. Madonna had the advantage, or disadvantage, if that's your point of view, of MTV and the visualization of her records, and therefore she could make everything look different. There are more images now, fewer images then. She realized that there was this new channel and she could use it. That's part of being a pop star. There's this demand for change and novelty. Our next article by Jessica Wakeman is titled, "This Model Launched a Modern Hot Sauce Company with Flavors That Harken Back to Her Childhood." Usually it's hot sauce that makes you cry. In the case of hot sauce founder Uba Hassan, it was getting her new business, Uba Hot, off the ground that brought on the tears. If Hassan looks familiar, it's because you've probably seen her. She has been the face of Ralph Lauren and photographed by some of the biggest names in fashion. Yet, when asked about becoming a hot sauce entrepreneur, Hassan humbly admits there was a steep learning curve and she felt it was her biggest challenge. Born in Somalia, Hassan immigrated to Canada with her family when she was 15 years old. They lived in a shelter for a year. She experienced snow for the first time and the culture shock of Canadian kids wearing baggy clothes and nail polish to school. After being scouted as a teenager, Hassan began modeling in Toronto and Vancouver before moving to New York City at 26. She recalls getting lost on her way to modeling go-sees or casting appointments. "I've cried in every park in New York," she jokes. At the same time, she started blending her hot sauce. In the sixth floor walk-up she shared with seven other models, Hassan mixed her homemade sauce. Like most models, she ate healthy most of the time, and like many, she wanted her food to have flavor. "I didn't want to eat steamed fish and steamed vegetables alone," Hassan says. So she would dice up a yellow pepper, some tomatoes, and a jalapeno, realizing it made her otherwise bland diet taste delicious. It's a normal food item her family makes. "Somalians love hot sauce," she says. Soon, Hassan's hot sauce became a hit with her friends. "I would make this hot sauce and put it in a jar and bring it to dinner," she says, "and people would grab it, like licking it. What is this? What is it?" When she received a seal of approval from the owner of a popular hot sauce store in Brooklyn, Hassan realized she had a business on her hands. And yes, calling the brand Uba Hot, which sounds a lot like Uber Hot, was intentional. Advised by a food scientist to introduce three products at once, Hassan perfected a trio of recipes. The yellow tanzanite from habanero peppers is full of heat and tang. Serrano emerald has a more mellow cilantro and garlic taste. And the Fresno ruby variety is like a sweet, mildly spicy condiment. This food founder had just gotten started with recipe development when the pandemic hit. Still, she forged ahead with her project. Serrano emerald was the trickiest to get right, and lived off her savings. Like many industries, modeling slowed down due to COVID-19, and that gave her time to really focus on developing Uba Hot. Although initially she felt panic about launching Uba Hot, she never doubted her drive. "I came to New York with $150 in my pocket," she recalls, noting how she experienced success in the competitive fashion world. She dug in and realized the decision was simple enough. "I'm going to do this." With modeling largely on hold, she launched into spicing up the food industry. Hassan says she felt like a fish out of water in the male-dominated world of food manufacturing. And like everyone in the business, she had to scramble to adapt to the complications of running a business in a pandemic. On top of that, she needed to learn the protocols and timelines for her new industry. In fashion, models, as well as makeup artists, photographers, and stylists, are usually paid hourly or with a day rate. As a result, things move fast and nobody wants a reputation for causing delays. "I work in an industry where time is money," she says. But leading a food business at a time of labor shortages and supply chain disruptions, Hassan had to tweak her expectations. "When I say I will do something, I always make it a priority to deliver," she says. It took time to adjust from being a model to operating a company in an industry that has so much uncertainty and unexpected challenges due to the current state of the world. A big part of that? Giving herself a break and accepting it's okay if we're going to finish tomorrow, she says. As this food trailblazer navigated running a new company in uncertain times, she leaned into her passion and determination. And there was a silver lining. She learned a lot from her crash course in product development, production, and sales. And the same passion that led her to feel panic when she met roadblocks also fueled her. "Every time I heard someone say it can't be done, I sat down and figured out a way to get it done," she says. "Often that meant doing it myself, making boxes, packing jars, affixing labels. I've done it all." She credits the director of contract manufacturing of a large yogurt company with helping her negotiate the culture of the industry and encouraging her along the way. Hassan hopes to grow Uba Hot, which at the moment is self-funded, and expand to offer other things she loves, chocolate, caffeine-free chai, and candles. Maybe she'll write a book. "One day I'll come up with something, but in the meantime, I love my job," she says. Make that jobs plural, model and entrepreneur. Our next article by Bridget Earley is titled "The Five Love Languages Explained." It takes more than the occasional great date to keep your relationship afloat. In fact, Dr. Gary Chapman, author of The Five Love Languages, The Secret to Love That Lasts, says the key to a lasting relationship is learning love languages. "I look at the love languages as a starting point for couples that point them in a direction for exploring how they can express love in a way that the other person finds meaningful. It all goes back to ways of packing attention," couples therapist and co-founder of Alchemy of Love, Angela Amias, tells Oprah Daily. "The concept of love languages is actually quite simple. There are five of them, each describing an expression of, you guessed it, love. The key is discovering which love language you and your partner respond to the most, then regularly putting that into practice. Finally, keep in mind that you may be nodding your head at the description for more than one of these love languages. That's normal." Amaya says people tend to express love via a primary and secondary love language, and potentially even more that may not be mentioned here. "There are more than just these love languages," Dr. Erica Evans, PhD, LMFT, tells Oprah Daily. "These are just the five overarching themes that came out of Chapman's particular research." Keep that in mind as you get acquainted with Chapman's method. What are the five love languages? 1, words of affirmation. These are verbal expressions of care and affection. Think, "Thanks for putting the kids to bed," or "You looked really nice today." Typically, the less generic and more specific the words, the more meaningful they feel to the recipient. Conversely, insults can be particularly upsetting to people who favor words of affirmation. 2, gifts. Tangible and intangible items that make you feel appreciated or noticed. Going to your partner's concert, for example, is as much a gift as flowers or that new wine decanter they want. To individuals who favor this love language, the absence of everyday gestures or a missed special occasion are particularly hurtful. 3, acts of service. Doing something helpful or kind for your partner, Think waking up with the baby in the middle of the night or doing the dishes so your partner can relax. For someone who favors acts of service, ambivalence or a lack of support are more damaging than anything else. Number 4, quality time. Quality time is a part of every relationship, but people who experience this as a love language will feel the benefits more keenly and crave time where both people are present without distraction. Quality time constitutes engaging in an activity together, particularly one you both enjoy, like a walk after dinner or watching TV with a platter of nachos. If this is your love language, having a distracted or distant partner that makes you feel unseen or unheard is the biggest pitfall. Number 5, physical touch. Physical expressions of love, whether sexual or more platonic, such as holding hands, a back scratch, a hug, a kiss, or intercourse. The absence of such can leave these individuals feeling isolated in a relationship. Knowing your love language can be one of the single most important things in a relationship, says Robin R. Milhausen, PhD, Associate Chair, Department of Family Relations and Applied Nutrition at the University of Guelph. Without this knowledge, you can miss that your partner is being loving and caring. Unfortunately, this can result in a vicious cycle of resentment that can ultimately lead to divorce or a breakup. If you really care and respect your partner, take the time to acquaint yourself with your love language and theirs, says Milhausen. With this knowledge, you'll be better equipped to meet your partner's emotional needs. Start by thinking about how you like to give and receive love, says Milhausen. Ask yourself, when I want to show affection, how do I do it? Do you cook a really nice meal? Or maybe you send an appreciative text or buy concert tickets. Often the way you express love can provide clues about what kind of love you most appreciate, says Milhausen. Next, think about what makes you feel most loved and cared for. Do you feel closest to your partner when they do something helpful? Or do you crave physical touch? Dig deep by thinking back to all your past relationships, both romantic and otherwise, says Milhausen. You can also take a 10 to 15 minute quiz that can be found online to help pinpoint your primary love language. And once you do, communicate your results to your partner to help them better understand what makes you feel appreciated. While it's important to know your love language, equally important is knowing your partner's. The way most of us express love is our own love language, which leads to relationship problems. When you understand your partner's love language, your expressions of love don't get lost in translation, Amaya says. Below, find tips for making your love known to someone with a different primary love language than yours. Words of affirmation. Pay attention to the thoughts you have about the person and work on vocalizing them, Amaya says. Essentially, leave a paper trail of your love through handwritten notes, spontaneous texts, and meaningful, specific compliments. Physical touch. Look for opportunities to physically connect with your loved one, whether that's a hug as you're crossing paths in the morning or a squeeze on the knee underneath a table during a dinner out with friends. Quality time. Work on being fully present with your partner. Amaya says that the biggest barrier to quality time is the use of cell phones. People whose love language is quality time will feel hurt if the partner is always checking their phone or half listening while doing other things, Amaya says. Other tips include starting a shared passion or hobby together or making long walks a staple in the routine. Acts of service. Step 1, get into the mindset of wanting to show your partner love non-verbally. That will help reframe tasks that seem like chores, like carpooling and doing the dishes, into expressions of love. Gift giving. What to get the expert gift giver? Amias recommends starting small. These gifts don't have to be extravagant. They're little representations of feelings and show how much you know your partner and how you pay attention to what they like, she says. Another alternative, you can't go wrong with the usual flowers and chocolate. Chapman's 30-year-old system is not the be-all end-all when it comes to relationships. Amias cautions against relying on the love languages to entirely guide your relationship. It can become too transactional, Amias says. For example, you shouldn't be thinking, if my love language is quality time and your love language is acts of service, if you spent 30 minutes talking to me, then I will rake the leaves. Exchanges like this shift the focus away from what should be at the core of the relationship, presence and connection. Instead of becoming myopically focused on speaking your partner's love language and having them speak yours, Think of the love languages as a starting point for tending to your relationship with a sense of generosity and goodwill. Our next article by Lane Dalfin is titled, What It Means to Dream That You're Being Robbed. In my dream, I'm at a restaurant watching the waitress serve a course to each person at the table. When she gets to me, she reaches from across the table and spills the food into my place setting. I immediately realize that the spill was a decoy, and I spin around to see a man running out the back door of the restaurant with my purse in his hand. I turn back around and stare at the waitress. I know what she just did, and then I wake up. Signed, Wise Customer. Dear WC, when trying to find the current situation that any dream reflects, you need to explore what the different components mean to you specifically. For example, what meaning does your purse hold for you? Consider the items you might find inside your handbag. Let's start with money. If you connect money with your sense of self-worth, ask yourself if something happened recently that made you feel devalued in some way. Did someone discount your opinion, perhaps? Did you take an action that was criticized or make a request that was ignored? What else might one find in a purse? How about cards that share your identity? If you did feel belittled in some recent situation, did it make you think less of yourself? Here's an example of what I mean. When I'm in a business meeting and I offer up an idea that is criticized by someone at the table, my first response might be to believe my ideas aren't valuable. If this experience resonates for you, then your dream could indeed be reflecting a sensation that your positive sense of identity and self-worth has been stolen from you. Alternatively, you might uncover the waking life situation that your dream's trying to tell you about by exploring the main actions in the dream. The waitress distracts you, and then her partner in crime steals your bag. Did you recently catch someone in the act of being dishonest? Or perhaps you've noted someone reaching out to serve you in a way that felt insincere? Have you ever heard the expression, she or he never gives unless there's a get? Do you feel this way about someone in your life? If you've already been on the lookout for a certain someone's ulterior motive, a recent show of generosity on their part could trigger a dream such as this. It's like you're saying to yourself, I'm not going to be fooled anymore. Now let's focus on the emotions displayed within the dream. You're convinced that the waitress is deceiving you. Whether or not the current life situation that the scenario points to involved a deliberate attempt to deceive, the events of this dream leave you feeling robbed and, most importantly, tricked. Ask yourself whether you've experienced those feelings recently in your life, and if so, who is making you feel taken advantage of? We've established that this dream points to a conversation you're having with yourself about an event or relationship where you felt robbed, perhaps devalued, and either tricked or taken advantage of in some way. So how can you continue the internal conversation to find solutions for your situation? We've already touched on one possibility. If you realize someone has reached out to you insincerely or intentionally deceived you, this dream helps you to accept that reality and keep your guard up next time this person approaches you. Here's another. If your waking situation makes you feel robbed of your identity or self-worth by showing someone stealing your purse, your dream reminds you that your identity and self-worth belong to you. No one else can take them away from you legitimately. You alone have the power to change how you see yourself, and you can hold on to those metaphorical valuables by refusing to feel devalued based on someone else's opinion of you. The dream's ending holds a third potential solution. At the very end, you write, I spin around and stare at the waitress. I know what she just did, and then I wake up. Often, a dream's solution can be found by noticing what's missing. What's amiss in this ending? Simply that you stare silently instead of confronting the waitress for her deceit. If someone was dishonest with you, might this dream be reflecting some inaction from you in the face of feeling tricked or robbed? If so, consider changing the story by expressing your thoughts directly to the person involved. Our next article by Karen Duffy is titled, How to Be Perfect Will Help You Live in the Here and Now. Bibliotherapy is the practice of reading to heal the mind and soul. The book can be anything, novels, poetry, the Cambridge World History of Food, 50 Shades of Grey, or philosophy. Sigmund Freud used bibliotherapy on his anxious patients. No doubt he recommended books on cigars. In World War I, soldiers suffering shell shock, what we now call PTSD, were given books to help ease their psychic wounds. The notion that reading is a mental salve is an old one. Over 3,000 years ago, the library at Thebes was inscribed with the motto, "A house of healing for the soul." We've been enduring a long, dark night of the soul, and we need the uplift of a good book now more than ever. Reading is an opportunity for escape from the everyday, but it's also an opportunity for reflection and mindfulness, a way to run a flashlight around in our thoughts. If you choose to read Plato's Apology, you'll be reminded of Socrates' maxim, "The unexamined life is not worth living." Fortunately, into this time of uncertainty has been born a clever and engaging book that is just the bibliotherapy the doctor ordered, How to Be Perfect by Michael Schur. If you recognize Schur's name, and it's most likely as the creator and writer of The Good Place, a sitcom about a group of dead people struggling in the afterlife to become better. Schur's genius was to make sure their journey, though filled with big, important questions, was also wildly entertaining. But if you're ready to examine your life and think deep thoughts before you pass over, Schur's new book is a very good place to begin. In How to Be Perfect, he surveys the history of moral philosophy across thousands of years in pursuit of answers to such essential questions as, am I a good person? Am I contributing to the world in a positive way, and am I doing it often enough? And also, am I spending too much time navel-gazing instead of just getting on with life? Schur's gift to the reader is his ability to distill the writing of ancient philosophers such as Aristotle and Socrates, more recent ones such as John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham, and modern thinkers such as Pamela Hieronymi and Peter Singer into breezy, engrossing chapters. It's as if the author has his arm around your shoulder and is whispering in your ear, "Come on, give it a go. This is going to be fun." It's a lively romp through moral philosophy that's not dumbed down to be the philosophical equivalent of the chicken dance. I'm relieved that Schur doesn't give us 12 rules to live by or a fixed list of ways to be good. How to Be Perfect is joyously absent of the bossing around you get from certain self-help scolds. Instead, Schur's approach is flexible. He offers lots of ways to examine a situation and make moral decisions. As we continue to navigate the new world we live in, Schur gives us not one roadmap, but many. Despite its somewhat daunting title, How to Be Perfect doesn't expect perfection from the reader. Schur knows we all contain, in the words of the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, flowers and garbage. His approach to living an ethical life is not memorizing Immanuel Kant's Metaphysics of Morals. Rather, he simply wants us to care about living a good life and be conscious of our beliefs and actions. Doing good is hard, and we will fail, he reassures us. But in the words of Samuel Beckett, ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, fail better. I'm not a doctor, but as bibliotherapy, I prescribe How to Be Perfect to anyone trying to make moral choices in a complex and confusing world, which is all of us. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, Oprah Reacts to Holding the Maya Angelou Quarter for the First Time. Next time you receive change from a cashier, take a look at the palm of your hand. There's a chance Dr. Maya Angelou's likeness will be staring back at you. This month, the U.S. Mint began rolling out a quarter commemorating the poet, activist, author, and giver of timeless wisdom, marking the first time a black woman has appeared on a quarter. The special edition quarter may be worth 25 cents, but for Oprah, who considered Dr. Angelou her mother friend, the currency is priceless. At her home, Oprah finally got a chance to hold the commemorative coin. I have here in my hand a true treasure, so magnificent it makes me want to cry, says Oprah in a video posted to Instagram, shuffling around the quarters in her hand. It's official. Maya Angelou is on the quarter. Dr. Angelou is part of the four-year American Women Quarters program. From 22 to 2025, the U.S. Mint will issue up to 5 new editions of the quarter, each featuring a different portrait of a notable woman on the tail side of the coin opposite a portrait of George Washington. Other women being honored in 2022 include American film star Anna Mae Wong, astronaut Sally Ride, American Cherokee activist Wilma Mankiller, and suffragist Nina Otero Warren, who will also receive their own special edition quarters. Dr. Angelou's quarter was created by Emily Dampstra, who also designed Wong's quarter, to contain symbols that honor Dr. Angelou's career as a poet and beacon of inspiration. Dr. Angelou's outstretched arms are shadowed by a bird's wings, referencing her 1969 memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. She is surrounded by sun rays, or perhaps she is emitting those rays herself. The bird in flight and the rising sun are imagery that she incorporated in her own writing and are also symbolic of the way she lived, Dampstra told ArtNet in an interview. Another poignant tidbit, Dampstra modeled the bird's wings after a purple martin, a songbird found in Dr. Angelou's native Arkansas. To Oprah, the quarter captures the triumph of Dr. Angelou's trajectory, from a girl growing up in the Jim Crow South to a celebrated poet who performed at presidential inaugurations. It's so incredible that a young black girl growing up in Stamps, Arkansas, who was put through everything that she had to endure, including losing her voice at a young age, then became one of the world's greatest poets, allowing us all to find our voices, Oprah said. This is an incredible moment. Oprah has said, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings was the first time she saw herself in a character. In addition to loving her words, Oprah looked to Dr. Angelou as a spiritual teacher. The world knows her as a poet, but at the heart of her, she was a teacher, Oprah said of Dr. Angelou when she passed away at the age of 86 in 2014. When you learn, teach. When you get, give, is one of my best lessons from her. Holding the quarter, though, Oprah felt Dr. Angelou's presence. I know that wherever she is in the ether or the spirit world, she is laughing out loud with that ha 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 Maya laugh. What a beautiful thing. Maya, look at what you did, Oprah said. We'll end this week with a quote from Oprah. To be authentic, we must cultivate the courage to be imperfect and vulnerable. We have to believe that we are fundamentally worthy of love and acceptance, just as we are. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.